Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Bold Sidebar podcast. This is your host, Jeff Horn, talking all things New Jersey Supreme Court. Two big things have happened since the last podcast. But first, I'll just tease and I'll speak more at the end that the court on May 21, 2021, dismissed 300,000 old matters, 300,000 cases that were unresolved for more than 27 years. These are municipal court cases, motor vehicle and the like. All of the cases are dismissed. The list will be or is on the court website. All bench warrants are recalled and all driver's license suspensions are revoked or rescinded. So I'm going to speak more to that at the end, but we have a huge case today. And the case name is State v. Michelle Ladzinski. You may not remember that, but for the past 30 years, the disappearance of Timothy Wiltsey, a five-year-old boy in Sayreville, New Jersey, has caught the attention of the media. Michelle Ladzinski is Timothy Wiltsey's mother. She was the suspect from day one, and it took 25 years for the case to actually be brought to trial. And on May 26, 2021, the New Jersey Supreme Court upheld the conviction, but in a most strange way and in a rare way. And I'll speak to that in just a second. What is the disappearance of Timothy Wiltsey? Timothy Wiltsey was 5 years of age on May 25, 1991, when he disappeared from a carnival at Sayreville. He was with his mom, and his mom's babysitter and niece found Michelle, but couldn't find Timmy. Michelle said, "I had gotten soda," turned around, and he was gone. Well, that led, as I say, to a 25-year investigation, cold for most of that time, and a conviction in 2016. The little boy was at the Sayreville Carnival. That's what the mother said. No one else could really verify that. There were some witnesses that said, yeah, I saw a kid that fit the description. But you can imagine, it's a carnival, there's rides, there's loads of kids running around. And later on, when the case was actually tried, these witnesses had little to add some 25 years after that May 25, 1991 carnival. Well, little Timmy, it's undisputed, was dressed in a t-shirt, shorts, and recently purchased Ninja Turtle sneakers. There had been no overt abuse cases opened against Michelle. In fact, people said it looked like she was an affectionate parent, put the kid in Catholic school, and hustled to make ends meet. The child was late to school 63 times and absent from school 25 times during the kindergarten year. And it would seem from the facts set forth in the opinion that she had a rough time keeping jobs, rough time having stable relationships, etc. On the night of the disappearance, a mad search by the authorities ensued. Police brought Michelle to her home to get some personal items of Timmy that might aid in the search, get the dogs on the scent, and the like. After picking up the items, she asked the police to take her to a bar where her boyfriend worked, and she was in there for apparently something like 15 minutes. Later that night, the search was called off, and according to authorities, Michelle reacted with no emotion whatsoever. Indeed, it seems like Michelle reacted with little emotion throughout this investigation. She was questioned repeatedly by Sayreville, New Jersey State Police, even FBI. Why was the FBI involved? One of the narratives that Michelle offered was that she saw Timmy be abducted, and the abduction story changed as well. At one point, there was a woman named Ellen who was a go-go dancer and with whom Michelle had a passing acquaintanceship with. Ellen and two men. There was talk of a knife. There were different narratives depending upon who Michelle was talking to. She told one thing to her niece, another thing to the police, another thing to the FBI, another thing to a former boyfriend. All of these things kept a cloud over Michelle throughout the investigation. Within a few weeks, or actually a few months, a Ninja Turtle sneaker was found near Raritan Center. Time for a little editorializing. I actually worked at Raritan Center at this exact time and found this story a fascinating one in the news going back some 30 years ago. This is way before I was a lawyer. Back on track here. The shoe was found at what I'll call the back of the Raritan Center property. If you've been to Raritan Center, you've seen it right off exit 10 off the turnpike, and it's in Edison, and it's a huge plaza with a couple of very tall buildings and then a load of low slung office, flex space, warehouse, shipping, trucking, all manner of single-story buildings spread out over a huge campus that backs up to a creek and essentially to the Raritan River. So the shoe was found by a civilian who was just aware of what was going on. He picks up the shoe, puts it in a plastic bag, gives it to the police. That shoe matches exactly the box of shoes that Michelle had bought for Timmy about 2 weeks before the disappearance. Later, the second shoe is found and Timmy's skull is found. It's verified via dental records. The creek is dredged. Timmy's leg bones are located. The balance of the body is never recovered. There was also waistbands that would be comparable to the type of shorts that the child was wearing. And there is the blue blanket. The blue blanket, it seems to me, had a significant impact on the jury's decision to convict Michelle. A blue blanket was found in proximity to the other physical items, semi-buried. It was a distinctive blue blanket with a metallic component to it that was identified by the babysitter and the niece. Turns out further that the niece had a beef with Michelle because Michelle had had some role in her having to give up her children because of some drug problems unrelated to this incident. Others in the family stated they had never seen the blanket. The blue blanket is emphasized in the court's opinion as a key piece of evidence that lets this conviction stand together. Back to the Raritan centerpiece. What's the difference? Raritan Center is in Edison. The folks lived in Sayreville. The carnival was in Sayreville. Well, it turns out when Michelle was giving the police a list of her former employers, that she mentioned a business called Florida Fulfillment. And she told the police that Florida Fulfillment was based in Florida, or a Florida-based company. Well, it turns out that Michelle worked for Florida Fulfillment in Raritan Center. Another key piece of how this puzzle came together, both for the investigating authorities and ultimately for the jury. Now, a couple of the twists and turns here. A juror during the beginning of deliberations, in fact, juror number one, was tossed off the case because juror number one decided to independently research whether evidence should be photographed in place. Back to the blue blanket. The blue blanket had been discovered partially buried, but had not been photographed at the site. It had been excavated and taken back to a laboratory. Let me get to the laboratory piece of this. There was no laboratory evidence, no DNA, no hairs, nothing that ties Michelle to any of the physical evidence that was produced during the investigation and entered into evidence at trial. To me, a rare time when a defendant is going to be convicted without any sort of real scientific evidence, no DNA, no videos. Very interesting. Again, going back to 1991, sorry to keep flashing back and forth, but you've got no cell phones. You've got the very baby beginnings of the use of even email. Cameras are expensive and require a lot of human management to change out discs or tapes or et cetera. So you have a paucity of surveillance like we have now, where everyone has mobile phones with cameras, and everybody has a Ring doorbell, and all buildings have security cameras, etc. You can just imagine that had folks had cell phones, there would have been people taking cell phone videos at the May 25 Sayreville Carnival, and Timmy would have either been there or not been there. You would have seen him moving about. There's no doubt in my mind that did not exist. We were not the Shutterflies in 1991 that we are in 2021. So let's talk about the law a little bit. Two amicus briefs, one from Centurion Ministries and one from the ACLU, both focus on the fact that the defendant's motion for acquittal was denied, and perhaps denied based on the wrong standard. The appellate division upheld that denial. The court spoke in this Lodzinski case at length regarding State v. Reyes, R-E-Y-E-S, and State v. Williams, which state that when a defense motion is raised at the end of the state's case to dismiss a case because the state has failed to prove the elements of a crime, the court is bound to utilize the evidence presented by the state only and view it in the most favorable light to the state. After the entire trial is complete, however, a motion to set aside the verdict, a motion for acquittal, should be viewed in light of the entire record. The entire trial record is available to the trial court judge, and still the facts viewed most favorably to the state. So you get some clarity on the law as it relates to those standards out of this case. You've already deduced that Michelle Lodzinski, after a 28-day trial in 2016, was convicted, appellate division upheld, and now this opinion. Why is it a weird opinion? First of all, it's a per curiam opinion. It is a 3-3 opinion, and in essence, the real opinion is written by the concurring justice, Justice Patterson, remember Patterson with two T's, who is joined by Justice Solomon and Justice Fernandez-Vina. There is a passionate dissent from Justice Albin, joined by Justices LaVecchia and Pierre-Louis. Chief Justice Ratner did not participate in this case. Again, we know the justices do not have to say why they back out of a case, why they recuse themselves from a case. One can only envision that Justice Ratner may have been involved in the case in some form or fashion when he was an attorney in the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's pure speculation on my part, and no basis other than just the overlapping dates during which this investigation would have been underway and during which the FBI had a role on the lark that there was an interstate abduction or there was a out-of-state third-party actor. None of those theories were borne out for the defendant. And again, this is the dreaded 3-3 opinion, meaning a tie goes to the appellate division or the trial court. Whatever was ruled below stays intact. So this conviction remains intact. Again, per curiam, I have to look this up. According to the New Jersey Manual on Style for Judicial Opinions, per curiam is applied to all unsigned opinions. Black's Law Dictionary defines per curiam as the name given to an opinion that is rendered by the court where there is more than one judge. Well, that's kind of a vague and unhelpful definition from my investigation here. I find it odd. Again, you've got your three justices voting to uphold the conviction, and you've got three in dissent, and you've got a fantastic opinion by Judge Patterson in a concurring opinion. She lays out the facts like you're watching a movie. This is a really kind of a long opinion to read, but well worth it. I, of course, will attach a link to the show notes. Also here, you find footnotes, and the footnotes are quite long and voluminous, and it's sort of signs of the justices clashing. The justices for the majority speaking to the dissenting opinion. When you get into the dissenting opinion, which essentially says, hang on, there's nothing to really tie this defendant to a murder, and she was convicted of first-degree murder. There's plenty of circumstantial evidence, but nothing that specifically ties her to it. And Justice Albin speaks to the social issues that, it, in essence, part of the state's case was that Michelle Ludzinski had a sort of troubled life, economic hard times, housing hard times, and boyfriend hard times, and, of course, had a very difficult time getting Timmy to kindergarten. 63 lates, 25 absences, that all added up to motive, that was part of the state's theory, and Justice Albin seems really bothered by that, essentially saying that this is a conviction that goes to the heart of all single parenthood. Everybody who struggles ought not to be automatically labeled and categorized as, you know, desperate and capable of committing a crime. Right. We know there's a death and a dismemberment, and it's horrible. We know that the mom seems to be the only one around this child. Her theories of third parties and abductions bore no weight whatsoever. But do we know that she purposefully killed Timmy, buried the body, acted alone, acted with intent and malice? That's really the heart of Justice Albin's dissent. And it's also interesting that the Manual on Slaughter for Judicial Opinions speaks to underscoring, and it only speaks to underscoring where it relates to the proper use of citations and underscoring for cases, etc. In the dissent, Justice Albin underscores a number of words that I just found interesting and a little different from the normal opinions that you get out of the New Jersey Supreme Court, which are always thoughtful and really rather polite and rather unemotional. Here, there is a contrast that's worthy reading. You can only imagine a 28-day trial, death of a 5-year-old, and a cold case. Let's speak about the cold case a little bit. So again, it's 1991, May 25. Not much develops. The physical evidence is gathered over the next several months, and then the case is left in the cold case locker. Michelle moves to Florida and raises two other children. It's not until 2011 when Middlesex County Prosecutor's Investigator Scott Crocco gets a bad tip. A tip that leads nowhere. Nonetheless, Crocco and the Middlesex County Prosecutor's Office reopen the investigation and over the next 5 years put the case together that ends up in the conviction of Michelle Ludzinski in a 3-3 per curiam opinion. Just obviously tragedy of all tragedies, but a most interesting set of facts set forth by Justice Patterson and a very passionate dissent by Justice Albin. Very interesting case. I can envision some creative folks turning this into a dramatic series or a documentary on how cold cases end up in convictions. And I imagine there are people that know the players here, that were family of Ms. Ludzinski and Timothy Wiltsy, that would have strong opinions about how this turned out. So that's a long opinion. It's absolutely worth listening to this sucker and also reading the opinion. Now back to the 300,000 cases that the court dismissed. This is on the heels of the 2019 municipal court warrant purge, where the court purged 787,000 old warrants. Why is all this happening? Well, I want to tip my cap to a bunch of people here. First, I'll start with John Koufos, K-O-U-F-O-S. He's been on the podcast before. You can look him up. He is a leader in Right on Crime, which is a think tank that runs in. John runs around the country convincing states to get rid of old warrants and old tickets and old fines because it costs the states and counties and cities more to collect them. And all it does is take people that are maybe a little bit on the fringe of society and push them further out, push them from getting a job because they have no driver's license, because they had a suspension years ago, because they couldn't pay a fine years ago, on and on and on. So we have over a million fixes right here in the state of New Jersey. I tip my cap to John Kufos, right on crime, who is a national player now, but was the head of the New Jersey Reentry Corporation prior to taking on a national gig. Also, former Governor Jim McGreevy, who was a key player in the Reentry Corporation and really got the thing going in Jersey City and has really made a big impact. Also involved is my friend Joe Hayden, who's been on the podcast multiple times and has lent his talents, contacts to the New Jersey Reentry Corporation. And also former Governor Chris Christie, while in office, he got the ball rolling and got the courts and the legislature and everyone on board with this idea that it's smart business to get rid of these sort of petty fines and bench warrants and things like this over minor issues that occurred decades back, and the interest of justice being served by purging the records of a million old cases that they get off the books. No one has to track it. Those folks that might have been living on the edge of society maybe can come back in a little bit and get a driver's license, get a job, etc. So I thought that was really, really good work, and I would have spoken more about that if I didn't have this bombshell State v. Michelle Ludzinski opinion. All right, that's it for today. I'm working on a bunch of guests to help round out these conversations so you don't just have to listen to me. If you want to be a guest, you know something about the New Jersey Supreme Court, maybe you know something about per curiam opinions and why this weird per curiam concurring dissenting opinion comes out in a huge case, please get in touch with me. Easy to find. Likewise, if you have a case heading for the court, you've been to the court, you know something about the court, please get in touch with me. I'd be delighted to talk more. And that's it for today.